Well, thank you so much for tuning into the Psychology Is podcast. I'm Nick Fortino, and today I'm joined by Dr. Kendra Campbell. Welcome, Kendra.
Thank you. So excited to be here.
I'm excited to have you. We've been having various conversations focused on this topic of, you know, essentially assessing modern day psychiatry and modern day psychiatric practices. And I've been especially interested in talking to insiders, people who are themselves psychiatrists, who are seeing from within what some of the problems are with the way that modern day practices happen. So I came across, you know, I discovered you first by watching this video that went pretty viral on various platforms. I think you uploaded it to TikTok initially, but I saw it on Facebook and it was on many platforms. And I thought maybe we could start here with you essentially expressing what your main message was in that video.
Yeah, absolutely. And let me also just kind of say, so I'm a traditionally, just a quick background before I say that. So I am a traditionally trained psychiatrist. I, you know, went through traditional psychiatric training. I have two fellowships, and I worked in traditional psychiatry, mainstream psychiatry for about 4 or 5 years before kind of having my own personal awakening, discovering holistic medicine, and then sort of leaving. Now I run the organization Free Range Psychiatry. And that TikTok was basically on, you know, on our TikTok account for Free Range Psychiatry. So what that TikTok was about is essentially a large umbrella meta-analysis study was released a few weeks ago. And essentially, it was the kind of definitive study that finally put to rest this chemical imbalance myth, which has existed now for decades. Specifically, they were looking at serotonin, the relationship between serotonin and depression in this huge analysis. So it was an analysis of many other studies, basically found definitively there is no link. There is no relationship between serotonin and depression. And I may touch on this a little bit later, but this is actually something that had been known for many years. Like, it never actually was a theory. It's kind of the theory that never was. It's been a myth. So the study, when it came out, wasn't any news to me. I already knew that there was no connection there, but it was a big, huge study and it got a lot of publicity, which I am so grateful for because, you know, mainstream media outlets were covering this story. It just kind of went wild in the media, which I was extremely excited to see. So now all of a sudden, you know, everyone was, you know, lots of lay people and everybody was talking about, holy moly, like this whole time we've been kind of fed a lie about a chemical imbalance theory of depression. And now here's this huge influential study saying that that's not what, you know, that's not the case. So this brought up a lot of emotions for me kind of as this process was happening. And I think the big thing that it brought up for me was really this feeling of kind of sorrow and grief. So, you know, like I said, I was a traditionally trained psychiatrist. I prescribed psychotropic medications for years. And unfortunately, as I was reflecting on this, as this study came back, I actually thought back to, you know, especially my early years as a psychiatrist and when I was a resident, and I did in fact tell patients that they had a chemical imbalance. I know that those words came out of my mouth. I can recall it actually. And I, you know, I did so in the context of telling them that they should take this medication that I was prescribing. Unfortunately, at that time, I didn't know any better. I had been, you know, trained just like everyone else. And this was what was taught to me as a psychiatrist. I was taught that a chemical imbalance was a thing. Now, I wished at the time I had known better and I had actually looked at the data, which I now have done. And of course, now I know that there is no chemical imbalance. But, you know, just kind of thinking about how many patients that I had told that to, the fact that I had, you know, prescribed these medications, not knowing any better, I felt it in my heart. Like it hurt. And I just felt bad. I just felt so sorry for what I had done. And I realized that I wanted to make a public apology. I wanted to, you know, to get it off my chest so that everyone, you know, so that I could express basically, this is something that I did. I'm happy to say now that I'm not doing it anymore and I would never do it again, but it was a mistake that I made. And so I thought that the TikTok would be a good platform for doing that. And so that's essentially what I did. I just, you know, in the video, I basically said, hey, this study came out. And I just admitted to the fact that I had prescribed medications and that I had told people that they had a chemical imbalance, and apologized. I was a little scared, of course, to do this. It, you know, it was hard to hit the post button. I was definitely concerned about what could happen. I was even worried, like, could I get reported to the medical board? Like, you know, I had a lot of anxiety about doing it. But I did it because it felt like the right thing to do. Mm-hmm. And then, as you said, it was actually, I got enormous positive response. It did essentially kind of go viral. It was very popular, probably one of my most popular videos. And honestly, you know, I would say 95% of the feedback that I got was actually positive feedbacks. People thanking me for just being honest and real.
Honest and real. There's a few things I want to say in response to that. One, seriously, thank you so much. I have tremendous respect for the way that you are doing this. You know, many people are aware of this concept in psychology known as dissonance, cognitive dissonance. And so in case people who are not aware of it, what it's referring to is this uncomfortable feeling that arises as a result of inconsistency within ourselves. And there can be different types of inconsistencies within a person, including the way they act and the way they intend to act, or what they believe and then what they observe. And then, you know, in your case, I suppose it was this new evidence, probably, even though, again, you were probably, you hadn't bought into the serotonin hypothesis at that point, but still sounds like it brought about this discomfort and exposed this inconsistency between at least how you once practiced and then what you now understand to be true about the nature of various conditions. And then, of course, then there's all kinds of ways that people deal with that dissonance, and very common ways include dismissing it altogether, avoiding it, escaping it, drinking, smoking until you don't feel it anymore, whatever the escape requires. Or sometimes people essentially deny it. You know, they'll refute the study in some way, they'll refuse to believe it, or, you know, they change their beliefs or their behaviors to kind of match the new evidence that they're finding. And that's, of course, the right way to do it, the honorable way to do it. And that's what you've done. And I appreciate that so much, because it takes a lot of humility to admit that you would do things differently if you could go back. So I just wanted to say that, thank you from the bottom of my heart. And then also, I wanted to read just a few sentences from the abstract of this study that you're referring to. So this study was conducted by Dr. Joanna Moncrief and colleagues, about 1, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 others. And Dr. Moncrief was a guest on this podcast too, actually, so people can check out our conversation. And so I'll just read, like I said, a couple sentences from the abstract, and then I can link the whole study to the video here. But basically, so first couple of sentences, the serotonin hypothesis of depression is still influential. We aimed to synthesize and evaluate evidence on whether depression is associated with lowered serotonin concentration or activity in a systematic umbrella review of the principal relevant areas of research. They then talk about exactly what they did, of course, and this involved, it was like a meta-analysis of meta-analyses. In this analysis, there were, I'm looking here to get the exact number, there were, I believe, 12 meta-analyses included in this meta-analysis. So again, it was like meta-meta. Mm-hmm. And the final sentence here, the conclusion, is that the main areas of serotonin research provide no consistent evidence of there being an association between serotonin and depression, and no support for the hypothesis that depression is caused by lowered serotonin activity or concentrations. And then additionally, some evidence was consistent with the possibility that long-term antidepressant use reduces serotonin concentration, which supports the idea that I first saw proposed by Robert Whittaker, which is that it's possible that, ironically enough, these drugs are not correcting chemical imbalances, but they actually might be causing them. And there's indications of that found in these studies. So that was again a little taste of the abstract of this huge study. And so wanted to give people a taste of that. Again, I'll provide a link to it. Now, my next question to you is, what did you notice the reaction to be among psychiatrists?
Ooh, that's a big question. because I will get kind of emotional when I talk about this, because so I am still a part of several kind of Facebook groups and other online forums with traditional mainstream psychiatrists. I've thought many times that I might actually leave those forums, but I actually think it's important. And it's really fascinating to me to just sort of kind of be a bystander and kind of watch the conversations that happen. Uh-huh. So I clearly remember this was posted. A psychiatrist posted a link to this article. And then I read every single comment, and I think there were probably hundreds of comments. And what I read, it made me so sad. It made me angry. It was pretty horrible, honestly. Because when going back to what you said about cognitive dissonance, so I think that's exactly what happened, right? So all of a sudden now it's kind of like in your face, and these psychiatrists kind of have to like say something. They have to think something about this findings. They can't deny like how large of a study this was and all of that. But it was huge. I would say the most common response that I saw, it was just outright denial. So denial, basically saying that they never thought there was a chemical imbalance. Everyone was saying, I never told a patient there was a chemical imbalance. I never thought there was a chemical imbalance. Where did this chemical imbalance thing come from? We don't know. We never did. And I was just like floored. I was floored to see that was, you know, when I know for a fact that is absolutely not the case. I know for a fact because I've seen it happen thousands of times. I did it. I was trained by, you know, this is what I did in my training. I know this is something that happened. I'm not just a bystander here. And then the other thing was just kind of grasping at straws. The thing that I saw a lot was this, well, we don't really know how they work, but they work. So whatever, you know, we could just keep using them. This mantra of, you know, we don't really know how, but that doesn't really matter. You know, we can kind of anything basically to defend the use of them. Right. What I did not see was anybody who basically was any sort of admission, any sort of like, oh wow, you know, this is a bad thing, you know, what's happened, like have we harmed some patients in telling them that they have this? There was no acknowledgement of that at all. And honestly, it made me pretty sad and a little angry.
Yeah. And just to make it crystal clear for people, the serotonin hypothesis is exactly what justifies the use of antidepressant drugs, because of course these drugs purport to correct a chemical imbalance. SSRIs are selective serotonin reuptake inhibitors, essentially resulting in a net increase of serotonin circulation throughout the brain. And so again, this all rests on this theory that has at this point been undermined, debunked, no longer taken seriously by people who should be taken seriously. And so that's a huge, like, that's a next level of cognitive dissonance. It's not just that your belief system is being shaken. It's that your entire treatment approach is now called into major question. So that's just fascinating. And I mean, not that surprising that people would be in denial. Again, we kind of know how people react to dissonance, and there's always a lot of denial, a lot of justification, which again makes me just feel all the more respect for people like you who are willing to just say that, be honest, you know? So let me ask you this. I understand that you had already changed the way you practice and think about various psychological conditions, but even so, what bearing did this have on your practice?
Yeah, that's a great question. I mean, honestly, what it kind of did was actually drove a whole bunch of people to my practice, you know, because essentially I think, you know, there were a lot of us that already kind of knew that this was a myth. You know, there were clinicians and a lot of patients, I think, who had kind of figured this out on their own. But there were a lot of people who really didn't. And what I saw again was this, so many people just, you know, kind of, you know, general population of people seeing this, realizing, I mean, and I just have to say, like, I got so many comments. I received so many comments and emails, and just the stories that I've heard, like the heartbreaking stories. Like, for example, like, you know, I heard from somebody who was like in their 40s, you know, they were told when they were 13 that they had a chemical imbalance, and they have been medicated for decades, and they have been taking these medications every day for decades because they believed that they had a chemical imbalance because someone told them that. So to be doing something like that for decades, and then all of a sudden it comes out that it was never the case. And actually, even it was never even really a real theory at all. Mm-hmm. Right. I mean, I can't even imagine like what that would feel like. Like, you know, yeah, I got off topic there. I'm not sure if I answered your question, but yeah.
I mean, yeah. Would you say, I mean, thank you for mentioning that. That's very relevant to kind of think about real people and the effects that a myth like that had on very real people. Because of course, with decades of being on a drug like this, there are almost always adverse effects, and they're often quite significant. And then attempting to withdraw from drugs like this, first of all, needs to be done under professional supervision. Like, if you're listening to this and you're thinking about suddenly coming off your drugs, you shouldn't suddenly do that. Really, in the same way that no one should suddenly come off of any drug, legal or illegal, that they've been on for a long time. But so, yeah, thank you for bringing in that kind of real case. But yeah, so would you say that you had already departed from regularly prescribing psychotropic drugs this even came out?
Yes, 100%. So when I left, I guess it's been about 5 years ago since I left my job. I was running an emergency room in New York City. I left that job to basically found a free range psychiatry. That was the last time, except for a couple little rare cases where, like, you know, somebody in some acute psychosis and things like that, mm-hmm. but definitely no antidepressants have I prescribed in 5 years.
Wow.
And that's the other thing I wanted to finish off the thought about your question about how this affected, you know, my practice and things like that. So that's what I do. My expertise is getting people safely off of psychotropic medication. That's what I do. And so, again, when this video came out and when all this hit the news, of course, now all of these people who suddenly realized they were kind of taking these drugs for maybe no reason were kind of coming to me and saying, okay, I would like to get off of these and we need help. And I think that's a whole separate topic, but that's a big crisis that we have right now because there are millions of people, you know, taking these psychotropic medications. And I do believe the world is starting to wake up. I am seeing that people are starting to question it, especially because of the study. But even before that, I think it was starting to happen. People are just miserable on these medications and they are attempting to stop them. And big surprise here, they are incredibly difficult to stop. And of course, no informed consent when they were started that coming off of these drugs would be the single most difficult thing that anyone has ever done in their life. I've heard that from at least 1,000 patients have told me it was the most difficult thing. And these are people who have gone through quite difficult lives, but they're saying that coming off of these drugs are the hardest thing. And so we do not have enough clinicians who understand anything about psychotropic withdrawal. Just the average psychiatrist doesn't even think it's a thing, much less do they have any experience or expertise in it. And so I'm actually one of very few, there's literally a handful of us in the world who actually have knowledge and experience in doing this. Mm-hmm. And so if anything, it was honestly a little bit overwhelming because I got a lot of people kind of, you know, coming and saying, hey, help, you know? So there's just so many people out there who need this help, you know?
Gosh, yeah. Well, I don't think I was fully aware of that kind of specialty. I've heard you talk about it a little bit, but I didn't realize that was like a significant core part of your practice. So that's amazing. It's amazing. And I'm so glad that I can introduce you to the Psychology A's audience here, because I know I've heard from many people, you know, through comments and emails who are desperately seeking guidance for withdrawal. So I'm so glad that I can connect them to you as a resource, and not to further overwhelm you, but again, I'm just so glad that I can connect you. So then, okay. I have this question for you. So you did traditional psychiatric training. You did 2 fellowships. Can you help us understand what does that training render you an expert in?
That's a great question. can you give a little bit more by what you mean about that?
Absolutely. I mean, what do you find your, like, when you completed that training and you stepped into the world as a professional psychiatrist, what was your expertise really in? Like, you know, like I think about my training and like as a psychologist and everything, and I think about my expertise was essentially like the general field of psychology and the sources of human emotion, thought and behavior, and the various therapeutic approaches to influencing that and social dynamics. So what would you say you spent the bulk of your time studying and becoming an expert in?
Gotcha. So a psychopharmacologist, essentially. I mean, that's what, you know, 99% of my training was in, was how to prescribe. And by the way, not deprescribe. That wasn't a part of, or maybe one lecture or something in all of my training was about deprescribing, but basically how to prescribe medications, how to manage their side effects. That's it, essentially. And just to note that when I decided that I wanted to leave that, you know, mainstream traditional psychiatry, and I learned what I call holistic psychiatry, I found out that there was no good training out there. There's no fellowship. There's very little. It's very, very difficult. So I actually completely self-taught myself about holistic medicine, about holistic psychiatry, and I self-taught myself in how to deprescribe and all these things. Since I've actually learned how to do it because I've just been doing it. I learned so much of what I'm doing just by doing it. But I frequently say, and I say this to people who ask me, you know, I want to do what you do. I would love to be a holistic psychiatrist. Like, how do I do that? And really, when I think about it, you know, the majority of my medical training, yes, some of the stuff, you know, especially the, you know, the basics of the, you know, anatomy and physiology and hormones, there was, you know, some of that has been helpful. But the majority of my psychiatric training, I do not use right now. You know, I mean, I use it somewhat because I guess you kind of do have to know the medications to deprescribe them. You do have to know a little bit about how they work, but the majority of what I learned, I'm not using right now. I'm no longer using. And I'm helping patients in a way that I never, ever, ever did when I was practicing traditional psychiatry.
It's fascinating. So just to further clarify too, because I think often when a kind of layperson is looking to experts for their own treatment or for anything, expertise, they see the credential and they don't know exactly what that credential means, what that represents, what training, what was involved in the training to get that credential. So you are an MD, right? Many people know a psychiatrist is a medical doctor. So my understanding, please fill in my blanks and correct me where I'm wrong, but my understanding is that you go through medical school, which is 4 years of very intense training, understanding anatomy, physiology, disease epidemiology. And then in your fourth year, my understanding is that you then choose what kind of doctor you want to be, and you begin applying for fellowships and or residencies. And so you did that. And so it's in that fourth year that you decide to become a psychiatrist. And then tell me, what's the difference between a residency and a fellowship?
So a residency is sort of mostly required for the specialty. So if you want to be a psychiatrist, you do a 4-year residency. If you want to work in internal medicine, it's a 3-year residency. And then if you want to subspecialize, essentially, you do a fellowship after that. So if you want to be an endocrinologist, you would do the 4 years of or 3 years of internal medicine and then an endocrinology fellowship. So it's kind of a subspecialization.
Thank you for clarifying that. So you then did a 4-year residency and then 2 fellowships after that.
Correct.
That's a lot of training. Mm-hmm. So, and I know, like, so clearly psychiatrists are very smart people, like lots of brain power there, lots of dedication, lots of discipline, extremely smart people. And my sense is that they don't necessarily end up with an expertise related to psychology and the origins of, you know, various emotional patterns. And then though they are in a position where they're dealing with people who are suffering from very difficult emotional patterns. And it seems like there's a big miss there, like that they are seen as an expert in the field of mental health, even an authority figure, but they actually lack psychological acumen. And I don't mean to say, like, I don't want to be offensive necessarily. You know, again, I very much respect the intensity of that training process and the intelligence required and the discipline required to complete it. But I just can't help but notice that it doesn't sound like there's much in the way of studying psychology, but then there's a lot in the way of dealing with people who are suffering psychologically. And to me, that's a major mismatch.
It's a huge problem. And I could go on and on about the history of why that is the case, right? There's a whole historical foundation. And of course, the involvement of the pharmaceutical companies in our education,
right. You know,
which I didn't realize how much of my education was actually pharmaceutical education or pharmaceutical company education. But yeah, there's a whole historical context of how, you know, 20, 30 years ago, that this wasn't the case. There was more of a psychological foundation. There was more of that, at least, maybe not even enough, I would say, but it was there. And over time, and with the influence of pharmaceuticals and this medicalization, right? The medicalization of mental illness, which there's a whole, I mean, there's so many, it's a very fascinating history. If you look at why that happened, like what were the conditions that, you know, forced us into this biological medicalization model. But because of that, and because of insurance company reimbursements, all of these bigger factors, it has shaped, you know, what medical education and psychiatric training looks like today. I have to 100% agree with you. It's you know, psyche actually means soul. Psychiatrist is actually supposed to be soul healer. I made a video about this where I basically say, you know, we're supposed to be soul healers, right? That's what we are, I guess, you know, our name implies, but it couldn't, what we do on a daily basis right now, the average psychiatrist is literally the exact opposite of that, I would say. We couldn't be further away from actual soul healing. We have morphed into something that is just, we're so off track. I can't even tell you, like, we've completely missed the mark. Like you say, we're supposed to be experts in mental illness and human suffering, emotions. And that's not what we are at all. You know,
I'm inclined to say, you know, that anyone who is aspiring to become a specialist who can really help people suffering, right? I'm inclined to say that you should definitely study psychology instead of psychiatry. Would you agree with that?
Yeah, that's a great question. And I don't know if I have the exact answer to it. And I'll say why too. So from my perspective, kind of what I see that I do, I have to kind of give a little background. So right now, what I do as a holistic psychiatrist, how I see that is, you know, I'm sure you're familiar with the biopsychosocial model. I think that has, don't completely agree with that, but I do think that is sort of informs that there are these different factors at play. I also like to add on spiritual and energetic, because I think those are the ones that we forget a lot, but maybe even the most important aspects. So when I say holistic, I really mean helping someone understanding a human being and understanding their suffering and helping them to heal by really being able to fully conceptualize and address every single one of those levels. And I think the psychological and the psychological and the spiritual, I would say, are really important. I mean, maybe even up there as the highest level. And I think it is helpful to have that. And I think it's great that we have people that are, you know, maybe experts mostly in that area. But I have to say, I also enjoy very much my perspective. This is the one thing, you know, people ask me a lot, if you had to do it again, would you become a doctor? And I say, I actually would. Mm-hmm. But it's because I think that from my perspective right now, having a medical background, understanding the anatomy, the physiology, the chemical, the biochemistry, all of that stuff, it does help me, right? It helps me to do what I do. And so it is a very specific specialty of, you know, a holistic approach. When my patients come to me, I do care about their vitamin B12 level, in addition to like their praying and in addition to their psychological, in addition to their emotional state. So I kind of just see the whole thing. So yes, I don't know. Hopefully I answered that question.
Perfectly. Yeah. Yeah, that's helpful. And I totally see what you mean. And it's interesting too, because I'm thinking, like, the thoughts that were coming to my mind here is, in a sense, you became an expert in the biological element through medical school, and then have spent time on your own learning a lot more about the psychological aspect, which of course probably happened through study and through working with so many people. And so I could imagine, like, that's a great approach to reach the holistic level, where you have an expertise and awareness of all these different levels. And then I could see that the path of becoming a psychologist and then learning about the biological aspect of things is also really important. And that's kind of how I would describe my journey, is I became a psychologist and then have continuously been learning about nervous system anatomy and physiology and hormone activity in the body and et cetera. So anyway, I couldn't agree more that seeing the whole person is essential. And it's to me too, one of the really complicated aspects of this whole issue is that we are exposing the flaws in the biomedical paradigm, the holes in that way of seeing a person. And yet at the same time, I definitely think that sometimes a person's psychological conditions are presentations of a biological condition. I definitely don't discount that possibility, but I just think that biological condition is definitely not a chemical imbalance. But there could very well be vitamin deficiencies, hormonal imbalances, straight up tumors in a person's brain even. I know Dr. Daniel Amen is kind of a pioneer in using brain scan technology to really look and see if there's a neurological abnormality that could explain the psychological condition. So it's interesting to kind of watch this process of us moving away from a biomedical model, but at the same time wanting to still acknowledge the possibility of biological causes. So that's just, yeah, commentary, I guess. It's interesting. I want to hear more about how you practice, what free range psychiatry is, how you would approach a person who's reporting to you that they feel extremely depressed, even suicidal or paralyzingly anxious. What is your general approach?
Yeah, great question. So first of all, I'll say, so Free Range Psychiatry, we're a nonprofit organization. Currently, we're 100% virtual. So we see patients basically via telemedicine. It's myself, another psychiatrist, and then we have a fellowship and some other staff as well that are a part of it. But so to answer your question, essentially when I have a human being in front of me who's suffering from depression and maybe even suicidal, it's exactly what I was just saying about this biopsychosocial spiritual energetic model, which is, and again, too, the way I, my understanding of how these different, is that they're kind of different levels almost, and they all interact with each other. So literally you can't, but if you just focus on the biological and you don't understand how the biological interacts with the psychological, you're also missing something, right? Because, you know, I want to talk to a patient about their diet, for example, but if they have childhood trauma around eating and all this stuff, like that's, I have to understand how that affects that. It's not just what they're eating, it's how they think about their eating. So it's really all kind of connected. So my general approach when I meet someone is basically to, first of all, I get a really thorough history, not the short abbreviated version that I learned in my training. it's quite different. So the way that I speak with somebody, the history, the questions that I ask them, these are not questions that I was ever trained to ask. Right. I asked all kinds of different things and really delve very deep into their childhood, their current psychological experiences, their social history, what they're eating on a day to day basis, like just kind of really everything. And usually then I will also do a set of like lab testing. So I do basic labs on everybody. Now, my basic labs are not the same as a traditional psychiatrist basic labs, if they're even doing them, by the way. Mm-hmm. Mine are actually much more extensive. And then sometimes I even do more extensive lab testing, depending upon what I think might be going on with that person. And then essentially I come up with kind of a formulation or understanding of what I think is sort of contributing to their depression and their suicidal thoughts. And I also want to just add here too, that my approach is much less kind of paternalistic. It's much less doctor patient. I tell you stuff, you know, I tell the patient to do stuff and they do it. It is way more of a collaborative approach, and definitely when it comes to symptoms. So just a quick to veer off just for a moment. It's my belief that symptoms are not these random things that happen that we need to, you know, medicate or drug away, which is our current approach, right? You're depressed, you need an antidepressant to make it go away. I believe that symptoms are actually beautiful messengers. They are messengers from our, you know, body, mind, and spirit to draw our attention to something that's not going right. And what it's trying to draw our attention to is different for every person. So this is why the word depression is like meaningless to me. It means nothing. When someone tells me they have depression, that's great. That tells me nothing about anything about their experience of what depression actually is. And so it's about delving really deep with them, turning inward with them so that they can really find out where is this coming from? Where are these thoughts coming from? What is the message? What is that's trying to, that's trying to come out. And it always is, there always is a message and it always can be found. It's a process, of course, to get there, but it's very, very possible. So once I have an idea of, okay, these are the factors and they're very common things, honestly. Like I see the same, I could tell you probably like the five things that kind of affect everyone. They're just so common. I mean, the first one would be trauma. Okay, so that's, and I almost call that like the root of all the roots, because that's kind of the thing that then sets off the cascade of events that then causes other changes in other different levels. But there's always some sort of level of trauma, which also, of course, then causes these different psychological things that happen, different ways of interacting with other humans and the world and themselves. It just kind of sets the tone for everything. And then there are common biological things, like really so many of my patients have vitamin deficiencies. Almost all of my women especially have hormone imbalances. Those things are super common. And then, you know, a lot of it has to do a lot of times too with just kind of what someone is eating, their diet. Like that's, you know, can play a big, big role. I could go on, but those are sort of the big things. So the approach then that I have into helping this person, again, is to kind of identify what are the things that are going on. And then essentially we treat those things. So if they have a vitamin deficiency, I'm going to give them vitamins. If they have some trauma that has been unhealed, which 99.9999% of my patients do, then we're going to work on trying to actually heal, address that trauma. And when I say actually too, I mean, I trauma is stored on all of those levels. Right. Trauma is stored physically in our body. It's stored in our energetic body, our spiritual body, in our mind. So all of those levels that I discussed, trauma is stored. So in my experience, sometimes it takes multiple approaches at addressing all of those different levels before that trauma is really, really, really kind of fully healed. That's been my experience in working with patients, at least.
You were saying that there was like five things that are commonly at the root of these issues. And you mentioned trauma and then the biological. I was curious to hear the next three.
Yeah. I said five off the top of my head too, without thinking what they are.
Oh, okay. I mean, that's fine.
But, I can tell you what another one is. I think I would say another, just a big common thing that I see a lot is this idea of loss of authenticity. Yeah. Dr. Gabor Mate has this really great way of looking at it. He calls it, so, you know, that as children, we have this choice, right? Acceptance or authenticity. We have to choose. You don't get both. You either are authentic, you lose your parents' acceptance, or you go the other way. And what do? We all go for bye-bye authenticity because we go for acceptance. Yeah. And so what I see so much is, yes, that people are, don't even know. They're so out of touch with what their authentic self even is. They don't even know it. Yeah. So they don't even realize that they're disconnected, but they are disconnected. They're living lives that they think they should. They're in a relationship with a person who they're supposed to. They're in a career that they think they're supposed to be. Everything is what they should be doing, what they're supposed to be doing. And this lack of authenticity, it creates everything, right? It creates anxiety, it creates depression, it creates kind of everything. Right. And alongside of that too, which again, when I say these things, they're actually all connected. Again, right? I can't just say it's just this or that. They're all, they feed into each other. But then the other thing would be a disconnection from spirit. Yeah. So I actually kind of, the way that I see a lot of the so-called mental illness is it could be looked at a disconnection from everything, from body, mind, and spirit, right? We have become 100% disconnected, but especially that spiritual disconnection, I see that then manifest as on all these other levels and manifest as all these things that we call kind of mental illness. Mm-hmm. Again, all related to all these other things, related to the childhood trauma, related to all these things, experiences that we have, et cetera.
Beautiful. I love that you're highlighting the issue of inauthenticity. I agree. I think one of the factors too that I'll just kind of throw out there for people to consider is this self-esteem, a person's self-esteem, which, like you said, is literally connected to everything else. I just think that's always, there are many people who would go as far, like there's a self-esteem expert, his name's Nathaniel Brandon. I think he passed away but he wrote the book Six Pillars of Self-Esteem, and he's got this quote that I often like share with my students, which I'll paraphrase, but basically he goes as far to say that he believes that almost every mental disturbance, everything that we deem a psychological disorder, a mental disorder, is at its root an issue with self-esteem. And, you know, if you think of self-esteem as the quality of your relationship with yourself, that kind of highlights how important it is, because that is the only relationship you can't get out of, essentially. So just wanted to kind of add that into your, you know, beautiful answers. Gosh. Let me ask you just a couple more questions if you have time for it. I want to ask you about your views of the DSM and whether you find it to be useful, whether you find yourself diagnosing based on it, the validity of it. But I'll just say as a caveat, this is a topic of conversation with many critics that I speak with. And there's a range, you know, of people who are ready to, you know, to quote our last guest, Sammy Tamimi, ceremonially burn the DSM. But then there's other people, I think, who find it to be problematic, but it has its place. I also think, as another caveat, that we talk about the DSM in general, but there's hundreds of conditions within it. And I think some of them have a little bit more construct validity than others do. So it's quite a difficult, fairly nuanced topic, but I would love to just hear your thoughts in this moment, you know, about the DSM, whether you use it and how credible you find it to be.
Oh, that's a really great question. I get this question a lot, so I can tell you, forgive me, but I do have a kind of a thing that I always say when people ask me this, which I think there are two good uses for the DSM, and that's toilet paper and like to start a fire. I guess I probably, you know, you're talking about people have different views and their beliefs about that. I'm probably far off on the, I find it completely unhelpful. Mm-hmm. I find it unuseful. I find it unhelpful. I find actually labels in general, like just actually labels at all, can cause a lot of problems in our lives, right? Anytime it's our ego, right? It's our ego identifying with something, and then it locks something in place. So labels in general can be problematic. Labels when it comes to mental health, oh my goodness, I know you've seen this so many times, like, you know, having that label, although I understand that initially, by the way, it can feel like a relief. I totally get that. And I've heard this, you know, I've had this conversation with a lot of my patients where they say, you know, in the beginning, oh God, it felt so good because I was told that there was a name for what I was experiencing. It was wonderful. But then over time, they realized that their connection to that label actually led to so many different problems down the line, not being able to let that go. Honestly, I find it to be completely ridiculously unhelpful, especially because I have a million things that I could say wrong with it. But I think one thing is, you know, it's symptom based, right? You know, it's based on symptoms. It's not based on causes. Right. You know, we don't do that in other areas of medicine. Mm-hmm. It doesn't make any sense. We don't say when you have a cough that you have a coughing disorder, right? Mm-hmm. We actually look for the cause, you know, whether it be tuberculosis or some other virus or whatnot. We actually look and explore the cause. So nowhere else in medicine does this exist. And if you think about it, it makes no sense. Just, you know, a pattern of symptoms. What does that tell you? It tells you nothing. Again, when I was explaining, you know, how I might approach someone with depression, if someone comes in and they tell me that, you know, they're not sleeping, they have depressed mood, suicidal thoughts, changes in energy, great. Okay, let's explore what is causing all of those things. To call it depression, it's meaningless. It's not helpful to me as a clinician. It's not helpful for me to create their treatment plan. And it's certainly, I believe, also unhelpful for the patient. Again, because now they have this label and now they are a person with depression. Right. And again, there is this over-identification. And I'm sure you've seen it many times, you know, 20 years later, people struggle with getting sort of out of underneath of that label. Yeah. And they struggle as seeing themselves as anything except for a person with depression.
Yeah, I mean, great answer. And it's funny because it was just a couple of days ago that I was speaking with, you know, another psychiatrist who I just mentioned, Sammy Tamimi, who thinks we should ceremonially burn the DSM. And he wrote a book called Insane Medicine. And this is one of the main points he makes. And he goes as far to say that a psychiatric diagnosis is not actually a diagnosis, because of the point you are making right now, that a diagnosis is like, you have tuberculosis, that's why you're coughing. It's pointing to causalities, but nothing in the DSM, all of which is framed as a diagnosis, does that. So I just think this is a pretty powerful point, and it's shaping my thinking around it. You know, I was already quite skeptical. I mean, my dissertation research brought me into analyzing every single edition of the DSM as I kind of tracked the construct of schizophrenia throughout all editions of the DSM. So, you know, I have all of them as PDFs on my computer. I refer to them often. I compare and look at, like, when did certain conditions be introduced in the first place? Like the ADHD, for example, wasn't even introduced until the DSM-3. And, you know, so like I said, it's shaping my thinking, and I was already skeptical, but this is kind of pushing me even into greater skepticism, because I'm hearing psychiatrists whose profession it was to use it and diagnose based on it, speaking like you're speaking. I do wonder about, like, you know, for the like, I don't even remember where I first heard this quote, but it was like on a documentary or something. And I heard someone say, real mental disorders are rare and unmistakable. And that was always a really interesting comment that stuck with me. And I think there's so much diagnostic overexpansion, there's so much overdiagnosing, and there's the ADHD, major depressive disorder, generalized anxiety disorder, obsessive compulsive disorder, which get diagnosed so frequently, it's hard to take them seriously anymore. So I'm very quick to, like, dismiss those and see those as lacking credibility. But then there's the ones like schizophrenia or like dissociative identity disorder, which are much less commonly diagnosed. And the symptomology does seem to be far more unique and a little more consistent throughout the editions of the DSM. So I wonder, like, let's just take the example of dissociative identity disorder. This seems to be a pretty clearly defined phenomenon that manifests in a pretty consistent way across people. So when you think of a condition like that, like, do you take that more seriously than you take ADHD, or do you kind of throw that out too?
Great question. I don't know that I take it if it's any or more or less seriously, but again, when you say DID, the first thing I think of is trauma. Yeah. Again, it's just trauma with a different name. Right. I mean, this is my opinion. I think you could really just throw away the DSM and just have one diagnosis and call it trauma and be done. Certainly how it manifests differently. Trauma may look like DID with one person. It may look like borderline with another person or schizophrenia, but at its root, it's still trauma. Again, so I still, to me, it's not so helpful. I mean, it's a helpful, I guess, in as much as it gives you a framework, I guess. I guess that could be the, you know, if I give it any kind of help whatsoever, sure, it gives you a little bit of a framework. But without acknowledging the cause, again, I don't really care so much about kind of the downstream manifestation. Right. Sure, it's important. You know, when you're helping somebody, it is important to understand their symptoms. It's important to understand their experiences. And sure, when somebody has anxiety versus psychosis versus whatever, yes, that plays into my work with them and my understanding of them, but at its root, it isn't helpful, because again, it's not saying anything about how are we going to kind of sort of treat this.
Makes sense.
Makes
sense. Would you see any value in developing, let's just say, not modifying the DSM, but developing a whole new manual of sorts that was framed more like manifestations of trauma or profiles of behavior? Would you find something like that to be useful?
Great question. Perhaps, kind of, yes. I think, but again, if we were framing it in what I think, like, the holistic understanding of it again, right? And that's just the thing I want to keep saying too, because again, like, when you have somebody with schizophrenia, for example, like, yes, it's trauma, but a lot of times there's other things too. There's all these biological things and whatever. So I guess, you know, I guess it could be helpful in some ways, as long as, again, we're thinking really about what is the root cause, what is the kind of causality behind all of this. You know, I'm sure, you know, it could be helpful.
Yeah. Fascinating. Well, maybe as one more question. Perhaps can you give us an example of a successful case of a person you've worked with where your approach, this holistic approach, was very successful? And so maybe how what they were presenting, how you approached it, and then what the outcome was.
Sure. Yeah. So the first case that kind of pops in my head, and luckily I have had a lot of good, I've had a lot of pretty good success with this, but definitely there's one, one young girl that pops into my head, and she was in her 20s. When she came to see me, she had the diagnosis of bipolar one, anxiety. I can't remember. She may have had a PTSD diagnosis. I think that's about it. I believe that she was on about four or five different medications. She had been to lots of different psychiatrists, and she was fairly, like, she wasn't acutely suicidal, but she definitely had like passive suicidal when she came to see me. So when she first started to work with me, she had a lot of symptoms. Actually, she had a lot of medical symptoms going on, just a lot of nausea and vomiting and different kinds of medical stuff going on, and just very anxious. She couldn't sleep. Lots of different issues going on. But at the same time, she came to me, like a lot of my patients do, with the idea that she would like to be on, actually the way she said it was, I would love to just at least be on less medication. She said, you know, I understand if we're not able to get me off completely, but just like less would be good because I'm having so many side effects. It's pretty horrible. And she was one of those patients too, that was so very motivated to do a lot of stuff, which is always really helpful. And so I did a like medical workup of her, multiple things I found. She had like her very, very low vitamin B12 level. She had hormonal imbalances. I diagnosed her with PCOS and endometriosis that had been missed by all these other doctors. So I found a lot of stuff that was going on sort of biologically. And then she also had quite a bit of trauma, just like I said, like a lot of my patients do, a lot of childhood trauma, sexual trauma, things like that. So basically, you know, my approach was to, I worked on the vitamin deficiencies. We worked on her hormone issues. I started actually at the time, this was years ago, I was doing a lot of mindfulness-based cognitive therapy. So I did that. We did work and therapy with around the trauma. I worked on her, like her diet, things she was eating, all different kinds of things. And luckily she was very, motivated to kind of engage and try these things. And then she was actually started feeling better literally within about 2 weeks. She was feeling substantially better. And so we decided, I think at the 1 month mark, to start the medication taper. So we started with, we do my approach. My approach is generally to do only one change per month. So every month I would see her, we would decrease one of her medications. I actually didn't get to do the very last bit of the taper because I went on maternity leave, and another psychiatrist saw her for her last couple of visits. But then I actually ended up touching base with her again afterwards because I just wanted to see how she was doing. And it was a success story in every way. Like I can't even explain it. She's sent me emails and stuff like that, and you know, told me how she's doing. But she was off all medications, and off the medications, she had no evidence of bipolar disorder. She had no mania, no psychosis. She wasn't depressed. She wasn't anxious. She now, you know, she has a full-time job. She has a fiance. She got a house. You know, just a huge success story in every way. And again, like, you know, it started off with this thinking that she couldn't even maybe barely get off of any medication. And I forgot to say too, that, you know, she had actually sought several second opinions. So her psychiatrist said, no way, no how, you have bipolar disorder. You can't come off of your medications. So she got a second opinion. They said, yeah, nope, you have bipolar disorder. You can't get off. She came to me as a third opinion after seeing my website. And of course I said, I think we could get you off, which is what I say to a lot of my patients. And it turns out, yeah, she was able to. So
that's so uplifting, inspiring, heartwarming, and encouraging, and makes me feel more optimistic. Awesome. I'm glad I asked that question. And it sounds like you have many such examples like that, which is just so amazing. I'm so grateful for you.
I'm so grateful that I get to do what I do. Everyone says, or a lot of people say this, but I really think I have the coolest job. Like, I love what I do. I get to help people in a way, like just the process of getting people off of these medications, getting them back. You know, I talked about how, just a quick aside here, I talked about how, you know, so-called mental illness is manifestation of all this disconnection. Unfortunately, psychotropic medications further that disconnection. So they disconnect us from our mind, body, and spirit. And so I can't even put into words how transformative it is to watch someone come off of these medications. I have had people say, I mean, it was like a spiritual awakening. I can see colors for the first time. I know what an emotion is. The world doesn't look black and gray. I have feeling, I have sensation. Like, it's literally like, it's incredible to watch people go through this and just kind of reconnect with themselves and the world and their spirit. I think, what an honor. I'm so, you know, grateful that I get to witness that I get to be a part of that. It's beautiful.
Sounds extremely fulfilling.
Yeah.
Wow. I mean, it sounds life-saving. You know, and it's really interesting too, is the last comment. Sometimes I read the comments that are left on the YouTube videos for like these podcasts and stuff. And it's funny. My collaborator, Robert's like, we need to get you away from these comments because some of them are fairly negative. And I was just reading one, which was like, you know, it was a comment on the conversation I had with Robert Whitaker. And basically it was like, well, what's the point of your conversation? What are you trying to do? Make us stop taking these life-saving drugs and just make me commit suicide? Was that what you want? And that's the belief system that people have around these drugs, is that they are life-saving. And then if I stop taking it, I might follow through with that suicide that I'm thinking about, or I might become psychotic. So this video is very timely. And do you have any comments about, like, should people expect any kind of worsening of their symptoms as they come off, or can it be done in a way where that can be avoided?
That's a great question. I just want to say real fast though, that yes, by the way, I mean, I get a lot of hate. I get a lot of hateful comments. And what I found fascinating, I didn't have this epiphany until I had my TikTok channel and I started having like hundreds of comments in a day. And I started realizing that these common phrases were being used again and again, life-saving, it's like diabetes, blah, 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 all these different things. And it finally occurred to me, these were all like drug company slogans, right? These were words and phrases that were invented by the pharmaceutical that had been embedded into our psyche.
That is
so deep that people think that they are having their own thought, but they're not. This is something, it's pretty profound. Like, this is the level that we're dealing with. And also, just like you were saying, this cognitive dissonance, I see that a lot, right? So I eventually realized that the people who are sending me all these hateful comments are the people who are on medications. And I believe they're the people that deep down inside, they know something isn't right. They have this feeling that something about it is not right, but they don't, it's that cognitive dissonance. They don't know, they can't figure it out because this is what they were told to do. And so I think that's where the anger comes out. So to backtrack to answer your question about what happens during the process of psychotropic med withdrawal, this is probably the most challenging part about it. And this is the thing I have to tell all of my patients before we start this process. I hate having to tell them this, but this is what I have to tell them, which is that it will get worse before it gets better. So to answer your question, not only is it a chance, it's 100%. During that process of withdrawal, because of, like you were saying about the chemical imbalance. So I just want to reiterate, I have no doubt in my mind, trust me, from my perspective as a psychiatrist and taking people off of these drugs, I can tell you they create a chemical imbalance. They create a chemical imbalance, a hormonal imbalance, nutritional imbalances. They throw off your body and system in a way that is so profound that, I mean, I have patients who 3 years off of coming, they're still having withdrawal symptoms. So, this is the level of what people go through. So because of that, anytime you are withdrawing a substance, this was what happened if you were taking heroin and you stopped taking heroin, right? You're not going to feel great when the first 3 days, if you come off of heroin, you're going to be nausea, vomiting, diarrhea, right? That's called withdrawal. And that physiological experience, there's a lot of things that I try to help patients with. We give them vitamins. We do all these things to kind of support that process, but it doesn't matter. Because it's a process of withdrawal, and because we are literally changing the levels of neurotransmitters and receptors are all kind of changing as you're going through this period, it's not fun. And the symptoms come up, depression comes up, anxiety comes up, suicidal thoughts come up. And this is why, again, this is why we need more people who do what I do. Because what I have seen, just quickly, I want to say that I have seen less knowledgeable psychiatrists and physicians doing the best. They just don't know. You know, I don't blame them. They just don't have this training or knowledge, but they don't realize that. So when they start to withdraw a patient off of a medication, the patient becomes acutely depressed or suicidal or whatever. Now, all of a sudden, two things happen. One, they say, well, that was the underlying disorder, which is horrible. Or even worse, there's a new disorder, because now that you're taking somebody off of the antibiotic, they're not, or antidepressant, they're not sleeping and they're thinking fast. Oh my goodness, it's mania. They have bipolar disorder. And next thing you know, a patient who was trying to come off of Prozac is now on Depakote and lithium and Risperdal. Gosh. I have seen this happen again and again and again and again. So much of what I do as a psychiatrist to help people come off of these is to just tell the people, like, I let them know in advance too. I give them a big thing. I say, listen, it's going to suck. You are going to be crying. You're going to be experiencing emotions that you didn't even know you had are going to be bubbling up. Stuff from your childhood is going to be bubbling up. You're going to have weird sensations in your body. So I, you know, really do a great job, or I try to do a great job of informing people of that. This is going to be part of the process, so that when it happens, though, they're prepared. And that's the difference. That's the difference. Like, it's, you know, once you know that something's going to happen, it gives you it people can handle it better. Makes sense. I've seen is people who are not being seen by me and they're doing it on their own because their psychiatrist or prescriber never told them what was going to happen. All of a sudden, now that they can't sleep, they're having to, all these things, you know, suicidal thoughts and stuff. They think they're going crazy. And, you know, and they may, you know, run back to their doctor and say, oh my gosh, I need help. And the help is going to be to put them on that medication, or worse yet, a new medication or more medications.
Yes. And it seems to me like, along with preparing them, setting expectations appropriately, you're also making it clear that this is something that you're going through. You're not going to this. It's not the new state. It's something you're getting through. It's the withdrawal process. So that's got to be helpful to remember too. Wow. I'm so encouraged talking to you. Like I said, I just feel very optimistic that there are people in place like yourself who are ready to help people who are desperate to regain, you know, to reclaim their lives, their power, their autonomy, their freedom, their sense of well-being. So I cannot thank you enough. I know I said that like 12 times already in this conversation, but seriously, I feel so much gratitude in my heart in this very moment for you and the work that you do.
I appreciate that so much. And right back at you too, by the way. I'm so happy that you have this podcast as a platform to speak to people like myself and speak and just sort of put that, get this message out there to as many people as possible. Cause that's what I want to see happen as well. Really. Yes. I just want people to have this information.
Do you have I know you have the website Free Range Psychiatry. I saw that. So when I do come across people who are looking for guidance around withdrawal, can I refer them to you or to your website?
Yeah, absolutely. There's all the information is on our website. We're actually in the process of even revamping that. They can book there. I'm actually even about to release. So we've been doing just mostly one-on-one, but I'm launching a group program. It's going to be like a monthly membership. So it's actually a more affordable option where we have like support groups and like all this kind of wraparound thing for people, like a whole sort of program for people going through the drug withdrawal. So that'll be available soon. And I don't know if you also want to put, but the other thing too, is we also have, so there's Free Range Psychiatry, and then we also have the Free Range Fellowship. The Free Range Fellowship is where I am and other people, we are training. It's open to actually all clinicians, but it's mostly psychiatrists and nurse practitioners. We're training them how to do this, holistic psychiatry, and how to specifically help people come off of these psychotropic medications. I did that. I founded the fellowship literally because once I realized that I was like one of the only people in the world doing this, which like still is a shocker to me every time I say that there aren't more people doing this. But that's when I realized, holy crap, like I need to be training other people because I'm only one person. And so that's why I've sort of launch the fellowship so that there are more people out there available when people need the help. So
good to know.
Yep.
Well, I trust we will talk again. We'll stay connected. I'll reach out to you for one reason or another, I'm sure. So I'll say goodbye for now. And thank you for your time today. What a great conversation. Thanks of course to all the listeners who are still here at the end of these long conversations. You know, you're the special audience who we're really catering to, is those of you who have an appetite for in-depth, nuanced, long conversations. So thanks to all of you. And Dr. Campbell, I hope you have a wonderful evening. Thanks again.
Same to you. Thank you so much.
You're welcome.